Hola, so let's go right into meditation. Please find a comfortable position. Taking refuge and arousing the motivation of bodhicitta, let's settle the body, speech, and mind in the natural states. Arrive at the conclusion of this initial settling with your awareness resting in its own place, still and clear. This place is your natural sanity, a place of clarity, of stillness, of balance. So don't move from here. But from this vantage point, briefly, imagine your body-mind as envisioned by the materialists. It'd be a helpful exercise. Imagine this body inherently existent, consisting of complex configurations of molecules, of cells, electric currents, your brain producing subjective experiences, again like a genie coming out of a lamp, dreams and thoughts and perceptions all produced by interactions of chemicals and electricity. Imagine it. All of it inherently real, except the mind that is simply more of an epiphenomenon. Now release this conceptual construct. Return to a radically empirical approach to viewing this body from the inside out, from the perspective of an embodied mind. Direct your attention to the entire field of the body, from the soles of the feet to the crown of the head. And from the inside out, view the body as a body, very impersonal, like a physiologist would look at it, but from the inside out. Body consisting of all the internal organs, the bone, the skin, the blood, and so on. Certainly such a body exists, it's no fantasy. And now from the inside out, look at the basis of designation. How you designate your body. On occasion, on the basis of this field of tactile sensations, when you say, my body feels unwell, my knee hurts, I feel really good. Now observe just this field of sensations, just the appearances without the imputation, body, matter. Nakedly observe. The appearances arising within this somatic field. And judge for yourself, among these myriad appearances, earth, water, fire, air, solidity, fluidity, warmth, motion, are you directly perceiving anything material or any of these appearances? Physical, material, in the sense of being composed of atoms. Do these sensations have any physical attributes whatsoever? Observe closely. See if there's anything that you know directly, apart from the appearances and your awareness of the appearances, neither of them being physical. Now within the field of tactile sensations, selectively focus on those sensations throughout the entire body that are clearly correlated with the flow, the rhythm of the respiration. Still hold your own ground. Let's say 10% of your awareness, just resting there in its own nature, self-aware. But 90% of your attention focused on these fluctuations within the field of the body. Corresponding to the in and out breath. When the breath in and out is long, note that it is long. When your whole system calms down, and the in and out breath are short, note that they are short. do make a point of relaxing deeply and releasing fully with every out-breath. And simply allow each in-breath to flow in without impeding it and without pulling it in. Breathe egolessly. By way of the breathing, this effortless breathing, observe your body settle in its own natural state. Observe over time how the blockages within the body dissolve away, imbalances evaporate. Energies flow more freely. And your body settles in a state of dynamic equilibrium. Observe how the body balances itself, breath by breath. Then over the next few minutes, incrementally, shift the primary focus of your attention from the objective physical sensations of the respiration throughout the body inward to become more and more vividly aware of being aware, so that the sensations of the respiration throughout the body gradually fade into the background, vividly aware of the experience of being aware. draw your awareness very much inwards, 90%, just resting in the awareness of awareness, with just the overflow, a 10% overflow of awareness, peripherally aware of just the rhythm of the breath. With just this peripheral awareness of the rhythm of the breath, now probe more deeply inwards. Right in upon your experience of being the observer, the one who is meditating, that which is aware. Probe deeply into your own experience of being the subject, the observer, the agent. We define awareness as that which is aware, that which is over here, attending to the sensations or appearances over there. What is it that is in here that observes that which is over there? Does it exist? If so, what are its characteristics? If you conclude that the observer is unfindable and therefore not existent, what is it that has failed to find, to identify the observer? Failed to find the agent? How can something that doesn't exist fail or succeed in anything? And when you see that your own awareness transcends the categories of existence and non-existence, nowhere to be found in either category, Rest in that knowing of the unfindability of your own awareness. Rest in the not finding. The emptiness of your own awareness. And then with your eyes open, your awareness evenly resting in the space in front of you with no object. Let all of your senses be open. The mind unimpeded. Observe the emptiness of all appearances, all spontaneously emerging from one source, the creative expressions of pristine awareness. And simply rest in not doing. Rest in being aware. Well, Naso, that was a little summary of everything we've done for the last 8 weeks. Warp drive from materialism to the Dzogchen. So you might want to do that a few more times to really unpack it. Well, Naso. But on a serious note, it's It's not too soon. Not too soon to begin on occasion just resting in the not doing. Because now I think all of you are very clear that not doing at the end of that trajectory is utterly, utterly, utterly different than not doing at the beginning of that trajectory. Leaving all of one's metaphysical assumptions unchallenged, unquestioned, being a full-blown, you know, member of the Church of Scientific Materialism and saying, I'm just practicing Dzogchen. You know, you'll see what a joke that is. And then the spectrum. And outwardly it looks the same. Even the technique can be the same. And the reality of it is utterly different. So I think everyone's clear on that one. If you're not, there's nothing more I can do. So for people here, people listening by podcast, you've been very much in my mind all the way through. So, but it's not too soon. With this kind of foundation, having, I think, some clear vision of the path, the sequence, the strategy for really setting out, for finding the path, or setting out on the path. The way I hope is quite clear now. And judging by the conversations I've had with quite a few of you, it is quite clear. So now and then, go ahead, don't be shy about just at the end of a session, for example, just resting in non-meditation. It's good to sow those seeds now and then watch them grow over the years. Okay, good. So I'd like to be able to respond, at least briefly, to any questions or points of clarity, clarification, specifically from people who have had the good fortune of having Glenn as your interviewer, to have your meetings with Glenn. Our time here has been limited, so I've not had the opportunity to get to know you, but better late than never, and better a little bit than nothing. So for those of you who had your interviews with Glenn, any points you'd like to raise that I might be able to help with? Anything coming up at all? And please do... Okay, Kathy first. Yep, and let's do get this recorded if we can. Maybe you can... It's... That's not going to go very far, so I think better just come up to where Claudio is and speak to the world.
So when you're doing the emptiness meditation that we did just then, yeah. And do you go back through the whole thing of colour, shape, or do you just go through where you're vaguely at?
Where, from where you're at, if you've already pretty much figured out the mind or awareness doesn't have a colour, like I've already kind of figured out you're not a Brazilian Bushman. You. There was some question about it, but I've made up my mind. So I don't have to work on that one. So that which is already clear, just sail right through and come to where you see there may be still some reification or where you're on the cutting edge of the blade.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And her name is Kathy, by the way. Anything else coming up? Now's your opportunity. Because this evening, apparently, we'll be doing various things. I've heard rumors. If there are no questions, then I have to give a big congratulations to Glenn. I know he's done a marvelous job. Yes, please. And please do introduce yourself.
My name is Flo.
Hi, Flo.
Hi. And I was wondering if you would give us the next step in terms of lucid dreaming. Gave us the perspective.
Sure.
And have you been doing that? Is there something else we can do?
Sure, very good. Mm-hmm. Enormous topic, but you asked for the next step. There are two avenues to go, and they're both good, but they are different, okay? Just like wave and particle. They're different, but they're both good. And so the way from kind of more the secular approach, which I respect completely, of Stephen LaBerge and so forth, is throughout the course of the day, really maintain a stance of prospective memory, to be on the alert, just like in the cultivation of mudita, we're on the alert for anybody who's manifesting virtue, anything good, and so forth and so on. But we keep our eyes open, the antenna up for it. So when in the daytime practice of lucid dreaming, be on the alert for any anomalies, anything out of the ordinary, right? Anything at all. Note it, and then kind of like, almost like you're shouting it in your mind, that's an anomaly. You know, kind of exaggerate. Like if you're on stage, you have to exaggerate a little bit so people, you know, if they're 200 feet away, they can see what you're, you know, trying to express. But say, that's an anomaly, okay? And then, whatever it is, just something out of the ordinary. Okay? Remember in Matrix, there was that cat that walked by, and then it went walked by a second time? And that was like, whoa, something's off. If you see that, you might want to quit. But any type of anomaly. And then when you see the anomaly, they say, that's odd, mentally, kind of like, that's odd. And then, I'm giving you the oral transmission of Stephen LaBerge, how odd? How odd? Maybe it's just odd, but if you really ask in this reflexive, critical way, how odd, then with your intelligence, which is completely adequate for this practice, you might see too odd. I must be dreaming. I must be dreaming. Okay? Because dreams are just peppered with anomalies, you know. And we just blithely go on through. I've heard some hysterical stories over the time of a person who was, you know, watching pigs fly, and he jumped out of a window and he flew, and then, you know, one anomaly, and he still didn't get it. You know, he did, and it was kind of like, how could you not see that, you know? And the answer is, well, we don't, you know. Cognitive deficit. We don't see that which is in plain sight. This is occurring everywhere in the world right now, and it occurs in dreams. So ask how odd is it, and then raise the question, might I be dreaming, right? And so if you want to do a chest, do what I'm doing right now, pull on your nose, and I don't think mine has gotten longer. Not everybody, because I've heard of somebody who has cartilage in their brain, in their dream nose, but for most people, their nose will get longer when you pull it, right? And that'll be your indicator. If your nose gets longer, like Pinocchio nose, that should tip you off. Another one is jump straight up and see if you just kind of float down. I've heard of one person reported to me, they tried that and they still came clunking down. The laws of gravity were still in their dream. They really believe in Newton, even when they're dreaming. Jeez. Try another one is close your mouth, put your fingers over your nose, and see if you can still breathe. And if you're dreaming, you may very well be able to breathe. Okay, so these are called state checks. And you do them during the daytime. What you're doing is building up a habit of this self-critical questioning, how odd, and then doing a state check. And if you do that, you know, 10, 15 times a day for a month, that habit will probably carry over into your dreams. You have 5 or 6 every night if you're a normal, you know, kind of normal pattern, in which case it's only a matter of time before you'll be cruising along and you say, that's odd. You don't really think you're dreaming, but how odd? That's very odd. Oh, that's very odd. You know, you see your nose coming out about a foot in front of you. So there's the secular approach. If it works, this is not one is better. It's just like which method of shamat is better, whatever works. But now the Dzogchen approach, the Buddhist approach, Padmasambhava's approach, within this context, this flow of shamatha, vipassana, Dzogchen, where the dream yoga comes after his introduction to Dzogchen. Here, with all this momentum of your shamatha, now I've got a really itchy nose, and it's still not growing longer. With this momentum of your shamatha, your vipassana, introduction to Dzogchen, and so forth, within that context of your practice in meditative equipoise, and then the dream-like or illusory-like way of viewing reality when you're out of meditation, then sustain that. But now Padmasambhava says, not this is like a dream, which is very standard for Madhyamaka practice. You rest in space-like samadhi, and then you come out and you're thinking again and again, this is like a dream. This is what Atisha teaches in the 7-point mind training. But he's not quite teaching Dzogchen. He's right on the cusp. But what Padmasambhava teaches in natural liberation when teaching dream yoga, and it's very common teaching, is in between sessions, kind of blast yourself by saying, this is a dream. This is a dream. Now, from the perspective of a sentient being, that's a false statement, right? Once you've pulled your nose, you've done a number of tests, and you see beyond all reasonable doubt, this is not a dream. I'm awake. I don't have a body lying in bed someplace. But we're not in conflict with that, any more than Tsongkhapa's in conflict with Longchen Rajchenpa, and one's right and one's wrong, right? They are viewing from different perspectives, and then problem solved. And so, quite true, you're acknowledging with your intelligence, I've done some state checks. I'm not dreaming. And now I'm going to shift. I'm going to bump myself. I'm going to almost force myself into another perspective from which it is true to say, this is a dream. And that, of course, is the perspective of Rigpa. So you're kind of working top down, bumping yourself, kind of pushing yourself out of this conventional perspective of samsaric mind, and really viewing this here as a dream, right? And the more you can deepen that and have a sense of the truth of that, the locus of your awareness is descending from your psyche, the coarse mind, to the substrate, and by to the substrate where this is all of this is appearing in the space of your mind. Nothing that appears has any existence outside of the space of the mind. And then just cut right on through that to viewing everything from Rigpa. So that's a very powerful approach, but you must have view. The shamatha vipassana would be very crucial. Otherwise, you may be just engaging in an act of self-delusion, which becoming a psychosis. You're not dreaming, and you're saying, I'm dreaming. You know, well, no, you're not, you know, from that perspective. Okay? And then, once you have clicked into, so I'm going to sum up a lot to keep you busy for the next months, once you have succeeded in becoming lucid, in other words, within the dream, you've shifted your axis. Again, it's the same thing. Shifted your axis. Instead of viewing the dream from within the dream, you're viewing it from the perspective of one who is awake, or one could say from the perspective of the substrate consciousness, with full access to your knowledge in the waking state. When we're dreaming, again, when we're caught up in the dream, we don't have access to a whole lot of our knowledge, right? And we can be very incredibly stupid, really, really stupid. You know, that means I can, at least, where, you know, it's just kind of like my mind has gone inside a peanut shell, so tiny. Well, you've shattered the peanut shell, you've broken through, so now you have full access to your database, your knowledge, your intelligence, and so forth of the waking state, but you're still manifesting in the dream. And then the first thing when you feel that shift of axis, you know, where that discontinuity of viewing the dream from the perspective not of the dreamed persona, but of the dreamer, right? Then the first thing to do is relax, because you'll probably get so excited you wake up, right? So the first thing is relax, and just kind of take it casually, you know, like, oh yeah, another, I've had one of these, you know, or 100, whatever. But see if you can relax while remaining engaged. So relax without losing the clarity. It's easy to relax and then fall right back asleep again. So don't do that. So relax without losing the clarity of the dream. Remain engaged, right? And then from there, it would be nice to have more than a 5-second lucid dream. So then, see if you can extend the stability, the continuity of your attention, but with, of course, without losing the sense of ease. So you don't start getting all agitated and stressed out, and you know, either wake up or whatever. Probably wake up, and so go for stability, but without losing relaxation. Then what would be the next step? Can you think what might that be? Increase the clarity without losing stability. Does that ring a bell? The three balances in practicing shamatha. Go for clarity. Now attend more closely. Look more attentively to the context of the dream, but also enhance the clarity of your lucidity. Because there's all different gradations of lucidity. You can be a little bit lucid, very lucid. So get more lucid. Start seeing if you can walk through walls, walk on water, breathe with your nose blocked and your mouth closed, and so forth and so on. Gain a clearer and clearer insight into the nature of dream reality. And then you're well on your way. Okay. Now, if we want to just take one more step, once you're really nailing it, you're really deeply comprehending the nature of dream reality, then with the greatest of ease, then you can simply close your eyes, or you can simply stop, and in a matter of seconds, the whole dream will vanish. Maintain your lucidity, go right down to the substrate consciousness, and be lucid in the dreamless state. And then, as I said, you're just right next door to Rigpa. Right? You're very close. But we'll leave that for next time. Okay. Yeah, good. So, Flo, thank you. Anything else coming up from the overflow, the cup runneth over people. Anything else coming up? Speak now or forever. Rest in your peace of mind. Going once? Yes, yes, please. And your name?
I'm Darren.
Darren, you're Darren. Oh, hi. Gotcha.
It's not so much about practice, but more about contemplative science.
Good. It's fine.
And the question was in terms of people achieving shamatha. You mentioned one sort of experiment, I guess, of accessing substrate consciousness, sure. Retrieving memories.
Sure.
Possibly going to the past.
Very life. Straightforward, yeah.
But my question was if you'd considered or thought about... you know, people with other traditions and things, say Paoxaida, for example.
I missed that. Paoxaida, yes.
Apparently there are people that have, many yogis spending a lot of time in retreat.
Sure.
And that tradition is very similar to the Suddhimagga jhanas. And I just wonder if you thought or considered a kind of a collaboration there in terms of people that are potentially already achieving shamatha and working with them to study it.
I'm certainly open to it. I've seen no interest whatsoever from their side. So there's that. And I've met someone. This is healthy skepticism. I don't think it's cynicism at all. It's healthy skepticism. But I met with a monk who was... I've met Paiok Sayadaw briefly once at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. It was a cordial meeting. But then I've heard, he's been to the States a couple of times at least. And for example, he was in Napa Valley outside of San Francisco, and he was there for a one-month retreat, led a one-month retreat. And what I heard through the grapevine, because my spies are everywhere, is that there were a number of people in that retreat who were encouraged to believe that they'd achieve shamatha in a month. Jhana. They don't talk about shamatha so much, but achieve jhana, the first jhana in a month. In a month. Did I say a month? And then it was over, and then they lost it. That makes me very skeptical. It just makes me extremely skeptical that they got it so easily and they lost it so easily. It just makes me almost inexorably drawn to the conclusion how you're using the word first jhana and the way I've learned it from the Theravada tradition, the Indian, the Tibetan, different. It's not to say it's impossible to achieve shamatha in a month. And it's also not impossible to get a PhD in astrophysics from MIT at the age of 12. It's not impossible. There are exceptional people. I'm not one of them, but I don't doubt that there are really exceptional people in physics, art, music, mathematics, and of course in Dharma as well, so I don't write it off. But then I met, beyond that, not too long ago, I met a monk who was very, very knowledgeable and had trained for years in Burma, I believe it was. It was with Paoxaya Sayadaw. And he stated that he'd achieved all the four jhanas, and my impression, I think he even said he went beyond that, into the formless, the arupya, dhatu. And so we had a cordial conversation, we remained a little bit in touch, but he clearly said, do you think this is possible to achieve the fourth jhana nowadays? He said, sure, why not? And then he made it very clear that he felt he had achieved the fourth jhana. And so then I asked him, this is all a friendly conversation. There's no combat here at all. And then I simply asked him, you achieved the fourth jhana. So this means that you are able to rest in samadhi for a couple of weeks with no breathing? Because that's what Buddhaghosa says. It's not an interpretation. It's what he says. Just like he says, if you've achieved the first jhana, you can remain continuously in samadhi for 24 hours straight, and that would be flawless samadhi with all the five jhana factors, full-fledged, full-bore, all the five obscurations or hindrances, totally dormant. And this means it's really effortless, and you can remain for 24 hours straight like a strong man who can remain standing for 24 hours at a stretch. Now, that's not an interpretation. That's what he says. And then what he says is if you've achieved the fourth jhana, your breathing totally stops, and you can remain in that state of this, just impeccable degree of samadhi in the fourth jhana, for as much as a couple of weeks at a time. And even if as I recall, I can't quote this, but even if a bullock train goes right by your meditation cushion, you'll just be completely oblivious of them, But not breathing for 2 weeks would be really quite interesting from a scientific perspective, because this person should be brain dead, irrevocably brain dead. And so I asked him, can you do that? And he said, oh, no, I've achieved the fourth jhana, but I haven't mastered it. That comes only if you've mastered the fourth jhana. So he said he'd achieved it, not mastered it. So I didn't pursue it because I just don't get any joy out of, just being confrontational for the sake of confrontational, especially on an individual. I'll be very confrontational with themes and statements, as you might have noticed by now. But when it comes personal, I have no interest in, it's not my job. But then you can go right back to Buddhaghosa. Is there any reference in Buddhaghosa or anywhere in the Pali Canon, a distinction drawn between achieving the fourth jhana and mastery of the fourth jhana? They made that one up. So they can say they've achieved the fourth jhana without actually having risen to the gold standard of what Buddhaghosa says. So this, I've seen this so many times by now, by Westerners who claim to have achieved jhanas, by Asians who claim, and time again, I really want to believe. I want to believe that people achieve this. That will be inspiring for everybody. I want to collaborate with them. I'd like to learn from them, so forth and so on. And I'm sorry to say, just time and time and time again, when I see people claiming it, and then I just compare their statements to the gold standard, and that's the gold standard of Buddhaghosa, of Tsongkhapa, of Padmasambhava, of great Indian masters, time and time and time again, it just doesn't even come close to the gold standard. So then I lose interest. Now, I do not believe that no one in Southeast Asia, for example, in Theravada tradition, I do not believe that no one's achieved jhana. In fact, I'm quite convinced some have. And I think there's some strong indicators of that. But I think it's far more rare than widely believed. And my own teacher, my own primary Theravada teacher, who, by all accounts, a great master, Balangoda Ananda Maitreya, say his name in the Theravada world, eyes light up. Oh, he was great. So it has no reflection on me. I'm just a little peanut. But with his compassion, he let me come under his guidance, and I trained with him. And so when I was living with him in his home temple in Udumula, and 35 years ago, I asked him in this country of Sri Lanka, with at that time 16 million people, and now it's much more than that, and Vipassana centers all over the place. I mean, it's about 85% Buddhist country. I asked him, how many people do you think in Sri Lanka, which he knows inside and out, this is his home, how many people do you think have achieved the first jhana in all of Sri Lanka? And he said, oh, you can count them on the fingers of one hand. So that makes me, sadly, a bit skeptical. But Darren wrote me an interesting note, and so nothing about it confidential. But it was a very good question, so I'll address that right now, too. And that is, we had this lovely experience where there's no question in my mind there was a lot of virtue. As we practiced Donglen, we sent out our prayers for the young child who's still alive and really took a turn for the better. Now, there's just no question that could have been coincidence. I mean, that was not a scientific study. But what we were doing was virtuous no matter what. And the child did get better. And so it all turned out well, regardless of whether there's definitely a causal relationship between our practice here and what happened thousands of miles away in Mongolia. So we can just rest and be happy that it turned out well so far. But then Darren was suggesting, well, maybe that's true. I think I sense a real open-mindedness from you. Maybe there was, in some subtle level, some, 50 people directing their loving thoughts and so forth to a child who was very, survival was very precarious. If that's the case, then why not subject this to a scientific study? Like, for example, during the next 8-week retreat, and do this, but in a scientific trial, where we find other people, there are certainly many, many people who are, in serious danger. And if there could be a statistical, let alone, we just get them, nail them every time we do it, 100% success rate, let alone that, which is frankly silly. But if there could be a statistical, clear impact that when this is done, there are greater chances of recovery and so forth, then that could make quite an impact on the scientific community, and the notion that the mind is located inside the brain and it's just a function of brain activity. I would like to think that, but my experience thus far makes me very unoptimistic in that regard for a very totally practical reason. And that is a fellow I know named Russell Targ, T-A-R-G. And he, during the 80s, it was mostly the 80s and 90s, something like that, something about 20 years. He's a PhD in physics, And he was working for the Stanford Research Institute, SRI, right next to Stanford University, but not part of the university. But the Stanford Research Institute, but it's a very credible research facility. And he worked for them as a researcher. And what he got interested in was precognition and remote viewing. Okay, so remote viewing, seeing things that are very far away, seeing with your mind, of course, and precognition, obviously, having some clear insight into something that has not yet occurred. And somehow, with his credentials, with his own credentials as a reputable physicist and this very reputable institution, he was able, over a period of 20 years, to get millions and millions of dollars of grants from, I believe it was the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department. I think it was those three, or at least two out of those three. But U.S. government funding. And of course, if you're getting money for this kind of thing from the government, you can be certain that it's they would like to get better spies and get better military, because that's where the money is, right? So they could have super spies, or if they could be, you know, having remote viewing into, let's say, some nuclear arsenals in the Soviet Union, then they'd really like to know about that, you know. So they figured, well, you know, what's a few million here or there? So they threw millions in his direction. And over the course of those 20 years or so, he states, and he attended one of my Dzogchen retreats years ago, and we've met since then. He said, over these 20 years of just doing open-minded but quite rigorous studies, he said he no longer believes in such paranormal abilities of precognition and remote viewing. He says, it's not a matter of belief. I know they're true. The evidence is so clear that like 60% accuracy, 60% accuracy of remote viewing, and he's actually studied it. Is it an inverse square? That is, if you're trying to see something that is far, is your accuracy, does it fall off? Like, you know, inverse square law, is it like that? And he said, no, it doesn't fall off. If you're remote viewing, whether it's 100 meters away or 100 kilometers away or 10,000 kilometers away, there's no impact. It's non-local. And he did all these studies and he published, and of course all of his reports went to the government. And I think when all is said and done, around 1990 or so, so maybe he started in the 70s, I guess, he submitted his report that for remote viewing, the accuracy was about 60%, which is way beyond statistical average. And then the government took all that in and then basically shut off all his funding. So it all dried up because they said, well, 60% is good, but we can't base policy. You know, lives are at stake. We can't base policy on a 60%, you know, kind of accuracy rating. And it was only a matter of months or just a couple of years after that that we learned some really important news from Iraq, according to that guy who was the vice president, that we have slam dunk certainty about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And therefore we, the United States, have the justification to invade the sovereign country and turned out to kill 500,000 people. And about 2,000 or 3,000 Americans died, but 500,000 Iraqis died. But that was based on really slam dunk. And Colin Powell, of course, reported that to the United Nations. So they gave up on extrasensory perception, but they relied upon somebody else. So I find it very sobering. But this then suggested not so optimistic. That if you have a bunch of people practicing Donglen and 60% of the time, I can tell you what to expect. Nothing. We've had Ian Stevenson, and then I'll have to take off. We've had Ian Stevenson for 40 years, and now Jim Tucker and other colleagues at the University of Virginia, very major university, Division of Perceptual Studies, doing rigorous research, coming up with an enormous amount of information on, you know, children who, beyond reason, all reasonable doubt, are really recalling past life experiences. And then also this book, Irreducible Mind. I mean, it's all put into one volume, about 800 pages long. Such a wealth of data, of evidence, of irreducible mind, that mind is not reducible to brain function, that precognition does occur, remote viewing does occur, children do have past life recall, there is continuity of individual consciousness after death. The evidence is all there in this very well-researched book. And it's been, if you check on Amazon, you see it's gotten endorsements from some very substantial people. And I find it immensely impressive how the scientific establishment is so successfully totally ignoring everything that they found, to the point that almost no scientist even knows that that data is there. And so they have imposed upon themselves a type of, how do you say, suppression of freedom of information far more effective than what the Chinese Communist government is able to do. But with much less expense. They brainwash their congregation so they won't even look in that direction. It's like mass hypnosis. So no, I'm not optimistic. But this doesn't mean that, you know, the whole scientific community and all of academia and so forth are completely hopeless. It just means that, as they say, if you're going to make an exceptional claim, come up with exceptional evidence. 60% doesn't cover it. Doing uncontrolled experiments of children who allegedly have past life recall, they can say, yada, yada, yada. You know, you're really naive. You know, and they'll find some way of just ignoring it, which they do extremely successfully. If, in contrast to everything that's gone on, and this has been going on for more than a century, since the time of William James, he was open-minded. He was very keen on psychic research and checking out anomalies and so forth. So was Alfred Russel Wallace, you know, the co-inventor or discovery of evolution, very open-minded, and was really looking into the anomalies, just what Richard Feynman said all scientists should do. Those two men did, while the rest of them, like a herd of sheep, you know, all turned their back on it. And but all this research, so-called psi research for 100 years, has basically been like throwing pebbles at a tank in terms of actually moving, you know, a paradigm shift. I mean, basically nothing, you know, for all, and so much data and so forth. And so it has to be more unequivocal. If anything is going to move that tank, I think of, you know, Tiananmen Square and that one guy just trying to stop the tank, you know. I don't want to stand in front of the tank with a flower. I want to bring out a howitzer. Metaphorically, I want to blow up the tank. I don't want to hurt any sentient being, but I want to blow up the tank, you know. That we've tried the flower. It didn't work very well. They all got incarcerated. They all disappeared, all those valiant souls who, you know, challenged the system. They just disappeared, right, like water into the sand. So if that's the way the tank responds, blow up the tank.
Who did in the glass table?
What's that?
The glass table.
What's about it? What is a glass table?
I don't know about it.
Well, I'll just end on this. Go ahead. What's a glass table?
Sorry. I thought maybe, you know.
No, I don't know anything.
All right, never mind.
Okay, but so here's the point. Let's blow up the tank. If something is false, let's make it manifestly, ridiculously obvious. Not 60%, not children are amazing, not an anecdote here and another anecdote there. Let's just make it flamboyantly obvious. Like when Galileo dropped a big thing and a little thing off the Tower of Pisa, it's just kind of not open for debate anymore, you know? And he asked simple questions, the ones that he could tackle, and came up with definitive results, and he laid the foundation for the last 400 years of growth of science by asking tractable questions that you can answer definitively with no baloney, no debate, no fluffing around trying to defend Aristotle, you know, by anybody who will look, and after a while everybody will look. And that's why Aristotle is now an interesting artifact of history, whereas science is cutting edge every single day. And so that's where I think the observatory comes in. This has never been done, not outside Tibet or classical Burma, India, and so forth, and get 10, 20, 30 people achieving shamatha, have scientists involved from the beginning and totally transparent. So if all 30 people, including myself, we just all go crazy. That's a possibility, you know. We just all go crazy. A lot of people think we're already there. In case you're wondering, don't be shocked when this retreat's over. They already think we're crazy. And I'm a whacked out California mystic hippie guru starting a cult. I'll let you know that's coming, you know. But have the scientists involved from the beginning and track the whole process. And then if out of this, out of 20, 30 people achieving shamatha, we have 20 or 30 of them under a controlled experiment, tapping into the substrate consciousness, coming up with critical memories. And the scientists, who are skeptical but open-minded, saying, we're watching every moment of this, then if that comes out, that's not going to be a statistical advantage. That's going to be front-page news. Let alone if such people, if Atisha is right, and Buddhaghosa is right, and so forth and so on, saying, you know, achieve this, then you have paranormal abilities, extrasensory perception, an ability to, as you, you know, from shamatha on into vipassana and so forth, you can really do cool stuff publicly, you know. But let it be behind closed doors with a scientist monitoring it, and let it come out anonymously. Otherwise, you could have some religious fundamentalists coming after you with an Uzi, because obviously you're demon possessed, you know. And so, yeah, don't you think?
Or the government.
Or the government. They'll kidnap you and want to squeeze your brain and make robots out of people like you. And so, you know, I've thought about all of these things.
But what about all the Air Force people who, like, retired from, you know, planes, and then when they retired, they were able to come out and say they saw things in the air?
Yeah, sure, and look at the... I know that. I know it very well. So, and look at the impact. Look at the impact on the scientific establishment from all of their reports, and it is zero. It's zero. I mean, come on. It's zero. People just laugh. Go to the scientific establishment and say, but what about all those reports of UFOs? And they roll their eyes. You know, that's it. I mean, that doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that these anecdotes thus far haven't had any significant impact at all. Look at the major media, where Michael Graziano gets right there on the front page of New York Times saying consciousness doesn't exist. Strawson comes out just a week ago and says, well, you know, we just have to know more about matter to show how matter can, you know, give rise to consciousness. I mean, they're willing to publish the biggest bullshit on the planet in New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, and all the other major media, but then when something anomalous comes out, or books come out that challenge the paradigm, they smother it to death. This marvelous book, Huxley's Church and Maxwell's Demon, it's some of the best science history writing I've ever seen. It's just an extremely good work and shows how did this happen, that science became totally dominated by scientific materialism. It reads like a novel, like a thriller. And then check it on Amazon. See where it's listed on Amazon. You know, just the things that challenge the paradigm get overlooked by the media, and that's how they kill it, by not looking at it. So, with benevolence, with compassion, with wisdom, as science has already shown its stuff, its insights, its paranormal abilities, its extrasensory perception, it's shown that. And we're all the recipients of it, gratefully so. You know, I find this little mechanism here very, very useful, my cell phone. But for the sake of parity, that meditators are not just grist for the mill of scientists studying their brains and appropriating everything they do to their own paradigm, which is what they've done thus far. Let's stand up and be counted. You know, and as they have professionally trained, very fine scientists, quite a number of whom I've met, just last Saturday, met with an excellent neuroscientist from the University of Pisa and somebody from the School of Engineering there, that is information engineering, open, interested, motivated. But of course, these people, they have 15 years of professional training and another 15 years of experience of research. So, in a spirit of benevolence, of kindness, of warmth, meeting their cordial open-mindedness with cordial open-mindedness, let's have our own people who have 15 years of training, you know, full-time professional, and step up and meet as partners in a spirit of friendship. So when I speak howitzer, I just want everybody, you know, but I'm going to say it again. When I speak, I use the war jargon and so forth, it's completely Buddhist, the howitzer and so forth. It's never directed to any person or institution, ever. If we do, then, you know, I should go to jail. No, it's only delusion. It's yamantaka. You know, it's yamantaka, really ferocious. But all that ferocity, all that power is focused only on delusion. That's it. Padmasambhava looked pretty fierce. I mean, you see anybody with a big spike with three skulls on it, you might want to be careful. You know, like, maybe I should be careful around this person, you know. Those skulls came from somewhere, you know. There's a ferocity there. There's a power there. It's good because it's all motivated by compassion. And the only thing we want to annihilate, to destroy, is delusion and its progeny. Okay? Thank you, Darren.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Enjoy your day.